Welcome to the 2020 Volume 2, Issue 1, Summer Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published June 22, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For figures, citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Part 1. Table of Contents. Benzeyev Aaron. 2020. Precy. The Arc of Love. How Our Romantic Lives Change Over Time. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 2, Number 1, 1-7. https://doi.org/10-33497/2020.2. Mun Cecilia. 2020. The Ontology of Long-Term Profound Love. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 2, Number 1, 8-19. https://doi.org/10-33497/2020.6. Originally published in a slightly different form on February 11, 2020 in Phenomenological Review. https://reviews.thofin.org/2020/02/11/review-aaron-ben-zeev-the-arc-of-love/. Faliva Iskra. 2020. Beyond I and Thou. Intimacy's Pronouns. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 2, Number 1, 20-26. https://doi.org/10-33497/2020.3.
Article 1. Precy. The Arc of Love. How Our Romantic Lives Change Over Time. By Aaron Benzeyev. Arc of Love. How Our Romantic Lives Change Over Time, 2019, examines the central issue of how to make love stay over time. The book is about long-term romantic love and how we go about developing it, or fail to do so. It is about building the foundations for this love and dealing with the difficulties that inevitably emerge in such a challenging and critical construction project. The book is not about a particular theory of love or specific philosophical view. It is about a central issue in understanding enduring profound love. It provides conceptual tools for this task. Some of these tools have been used by philosophers, mainly, but not merely, Aristotle and psychologists, and some are original. The combination of these tools with the extensive knowledge of relevant empirical studies provides a powerful presentation of the nature of romantic love and the circumstances in which it can turn into an enduring one. One may wonder whether the many references to empirical studies all share sufficiently similar notions of love. In response, I would say that the empirical studies are not intended to provide a general theory of love, but rather to deal with specific empirical claims that are valid or invalid, regardless of one's view of what love is. The book takes an optimistic perspective. Not only is enduring, profound love possible, it is also more common than most of us think. Yet the romantic road is often bumpy and long. Enticing romances encounter many blind alleys. How is the would-be lover to know when such romances are promenades for flourishing love and when they're dead-end streets? This précy focuses on four major themes of the book: how to make love last, philosophical models of romantic love, the clash between love and life, and how to find the one or two. How to make love last. Romantic ideology claims that true love overcomes all obstacles and that love lasts forever. This seductive claim is empirically questionable and has been debated by philosophers and psychologists. In the field of philosophy, the discussion has centered on the question of whether love is conditional, that is, whether it is dependent on anything. In the field of psychology, one finds conflicting views concerning the possibility of long-term romantic love. A large body of empirical research indicates that sexual desire decreases dramatically over time within relationships. Yet research also suggests that many long-term couples remain deeply in love. Coping with this apparent paradox requires making several conceptual distinctions. A crucial one is the difference between romantic intensity and romantic profundity. Romantic intensity is a snapshot of a momentary peak of passionate, often sexual, desire. Romantic profundity goes beyond mere romantic intensity and refers to the lover's broader and more enduring attitude. External change is highly significant in generating romantic intensity. In romantic depth, familiarity, stability, and development are tremendously important. While romantic novelty is useful in preventing boredom, romantic familiarity is valuable in promoting flourishing. The profundity of a romantic experience differs from the intensity with which it is felt. Profundity involves certain types of activities that take place over time. What the temporal dimension adds to romantic profundity is shared emotional experiences and interactions. In moving from mere romantic intensity to romantic profundity, it is not only time spent together that matters, but also time spent on activities during which the partners flourish. Thus, the joint activities that promote profound love require time to do so. If time is available, but the activities are missing, we wind up with an experience that is not profound. Romantic profundity involves friendship and sexual desire. Friendship takes time to develop and involves mutuality. Although we speak of unrequited love, we do not speak of unrequited friendship. At the beginning of a relationship, romantic intensity depends mainly on physical attractiveness. Over the years, the focus in a romantic relationship shifts from romantic intensity to romantic profundity, and from sexual desire to the yearning to be with each other. Romantic profundity is not threatened by a low frequency and intensity of sexual activity, but rather by a low quality of shared interactions, mutual support, and intimacy. A Russian proverb states that love and eggs are best when they are fresh. When it comes to eggs, we look for two things: taste and nutritional value. And it is when eggs are fresh that these are at their peak. Life gets more complicated when love is at stake. The intensity of excitement, the taste, is strongest when love is fresh, but the profundity of the connection, the nutritional value, is often best when love is mature. In order to understand the feasibility of long-term love, I suggest distinguishing between three major types of emotional experiences. 1. Acute emotions, 2. Extended emotions, and 3. Enduring emotions. Acute emotions are brief, almost instantaneous experiences. Extended emotions involve successive repetitions of experiences that are felt to belong to the same emotion. For example, being angry or jealous for hours. Compared to acute emotions, extended emotions last longer and occur more frequently. The intensity varies over the period of the episode, and the nature of the emotion can change somewhat. Enduring emotions are the longest lasting of the three and can persist for a lifetime. In addition to their duration and frequency, enduring emotions involve a qualitative, meaningful development and sometimes deterioration and a dispositional nature that unfolds over time. I argue that we typically experience emotions when we perceive positive or negative significant changes in our personal situation or in that of those related to us. This seems to work against the possibility of enduring romantic love, as a change cannot persist for an extended period. After a while, we consider the change as normal and it no longer stimulates us. Like burglar alarms going off when an intruder appears, emotions signal that something needs attention. When no attention is required, the signaling system can be switched off. In addressing this concern, I distinguish between external change and intrinsic development. Growth. Change is commonly taken to mean becoming different, typically without permanently losing one's characteristics or essence. Development is a specific type of change that involves a process of improving by expanding or refining. In its full sense, development involves becoming deeper and better. Acute emotions express our sensitivity to immediate change, whose time scale is often seconds or minutes. However, we also need a sensitivity to processes enduring months and years, which are essential for our thriving. In such sensitivity, reasoning, which combines past and present experiences to future development, is crucial. Models of romantic love. Two major philosophical models of romantic love are the care model and the dialogue model. The care model, which is the most popular model of love, focuses on the beloved's needs. Without question, caring is central in romantic love. It goes beyond a positive attitude toward and the wish to be with the beloved, seeking to enhance the beloved's well-being. In this view, genuine love has less to do with the lover's own needs and more to do with a strong concern for the other, accompanied by actual deeds. The care model is most relevant in loving relationships that involve significant inequality, such as parental love, love of God, or love for someone who is unwell. In such cases, there is nothing wrong with one-sided caring. However, among equals, as in the ideal form of romantic love, one-sided caring and love is problematic. This model seems to involve too passive an understanding of love and fails to capture the importance of the interactions between the two lovers that underlie romantic profundity. Caring is an important component in other models of romantic love as well. But in those models, caring is not necessarily the essence of love. And in any case, it is not sufficient for maintaining long-term profound romantic love. The dialogue model, whose origins can be traced back to Aristotle, has more recently been advanced by Martin Buber and Angelica Krebs. It considers the shared connection between the partners as the bedrock of love and views shared emotional states and joint activities as the foundational features of a connection. The connection amplifies the flourishing of the lovers as well as the flourishing of their relationship. Krebs further argues that love is not about each partner having the other as their object. Rather, love is about what happens between the partners. Thus, it is dialogical. In loving somebody, you enlarge yourself through closely interacting with and responding to the other person. We do not thrive in isolation. We are social creatures. In shared activities, the participants are integrated into a psychological whole, which is more than the sum total of two individual actions, Krebs 2014-2015. Unlike the care model, the dialogue model emphasizes the autonomy of lovers and their essential equality in establishing the romantic connection. Sharing can occur when one lover is not autonomous and the relationship is not one of equality. However, such sharing is not deep enough to sustain the development of long-term profound love. The romantic connection expresses the qualities of the romantic partnership that are different and more than the combined value of the lover's individual characteristics. Proponents of the dialogue model tend to transfer the importance of the romantic connection to the issue of the location of love, claiming that love is a property of, and in some formulations, even resides in, the connection between the two lovers. This claim is problematic. After all, feelings such as pain or enjoyment, which are essential to love, are not a property of the connection between the two lovers. Love is a psychological property of a lover. Accordingly, we would expect that some features of love, such as feelings, evaluations, and action tendencies, are properties of the lover, whereas other features, such as compatibility, resonance, and harmony, are properties of the connection. The clash between love and life. The claim, "I love you, but I am leaving you," seems paradoxical. If you love me, why should you leave me? After all, love implies the wish to be with the beloved and not to leave him. Despite this paradoxical tone, I claim that there is no paradox in this claim. Sometimes love and life clash, and we have to make compromises. One such compromise is leaving the one you love. Romantic love not only adds sweetness to our lives, it also enhances health, happiness, and flourishing. It makes us feel alive. We need to love in order to flourish. And it is equally true that profound love craves a flourishing life. Thus, we come to the thorny issue of whether to remain in a romantic relationship that prevents one's personal flourishing. In romantic compromises, we give up a romantic value, such as passionate love, in exchange for a non-romantic quality of life value. Such a compromise stems from the awareness that we are limited creatures. We cannot always meet our standards or achieve our ideals. Survival sometimes depends on being flexible, settling for something less or simply different than we might have wanted. Today, the prevailing view is love over life. Time and again, we hear that love always wins and love always finds a way. Life might not be the greatest enemy of love, but it often involves considerations that clash with romantic ones. To admit that in some circumstances life should take precedence over love is to admit the necessity of romantic compromises. Although romantic love has a very positive impact upon one's life, people need more than love to flourish. For love to thrive and endure, we need a good enough living framework. When romantic love thrives, it can contribute to the overall thriving. Sometimes, however, love and life conflict. And so, we can find ourselves asking, which takes precedence, love or life? This can be a hard call. At one extreme, one might sacrifice life for love. Let's remember Romeo and Juliet. At the other, one might sacrifice love for life, remaining in a loveless but otherwise comfortable marriage, for example. Of course, most of us make romantic decisions that fall somewhere between these harrowing poles. It is the strength of love, the nature of the life's demands, and the degree of conflict between them that dictate exactly where we wind up on that continuum. When intense desire is perceived as the core of romantic love, the conflict between romantic love and life ramps up. Such desire is usually brief and decreases with time. Life, by contrast, tends to last. A lover cannot be blind to life, and love does not always win. In any case, love cannot replace life. When love and life go head to head, love almost always loses, especially when it is based on intense desire. In the long run, it is when lovers nurture the connection between themselves and do things that enable each other to flourish that love is maintained and enhanced. That is how ties to the living framework are tightened. The statement that all you need is love indicates that love is everything. Although romantic love is extremely important for our happiness and flourishing, love is neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for a happy and thriving life. As it turns out, love is not everything in life, though it is often a central part of it. If indeed, love is not all we need, then it is certainly reasonable for some people to leave the one they love. Choosing a romantic partner. Itto Landau, 2017, presents two major approaches to life: aspiring to be the best and aspiring to improve. Landau leans toward the second approach, which is associated with meaningful development, and critiques the first, which often involves an endless, unproductive search for the best. In my book, I apply this distinction to the romantic realm by suggesting two related approaches: a comparative and a uniqueness approach. Being romantically meaningful in the first approach depends on a comparison of factors that are external to the connection between the two lovers. In the second approach, love depends mainly on the activities of the two lovers. Improving the connection between the two lovers, rather than finding the person with the best non-relational properties, is the most meaningful task of romantic profundity. If romantic meaning mainly concerns achieving the best, lovers will always be restless, consumed with concern about missing the perfect person, or perhaps the younger, richer, or more beautiful one. If, however, romantic flourishing mainly involves improvement, a couple holds much more the outcome in their hands. While the comparative approach is more natural during romantic abundance, the bond must be unique for it to endure. The comparative and uniqueness approaches make use of different scales for assessing romantic partners: a meritocracy scale and a suitability scale. The non-relational meritocracy scale, applied mostly in the comparative approach, measures things like external appearance and achievements. It is easy to identify and compare these traits. The more complex and relational suitability scale measures one's unique connection and depends on personal and circumstantial factors about which we do not have full knowledge. Should someone choose to marry a wealthy person? On the meritocracy scale, a big bank account can be a good thing, but such a person might score low on fidelity, which is a feature of the suitability scale, because money opens many romantic doors. Moreover, Wealthy people tend to believe that they are more deserving, and hence their caring behavior might be lower. Similarly, having a good sexual appetite is usually good, but a large discrepancy between the partner's sexual needs is not conducive to a romantic connection. If all the positives on someone's meritocracy scale are reduced by negatives on the suitability scale, it does not bode well for personal flourishing. Even if both partners score high on the meritocracy scale, but are not able to bring out the best in each other, which is crucial for thriving relationships, their suitability score will be low. In times of romantic abundance, the use of the meritocracy scale eliminates negative options, but the suitability scale is vital for choosing an enduring, profound partner. Needless to say, there are various degrees of suitability. At the initial stage of romantic relationships, suitability is not such a big deal. After all, information about long-term profound suitability is not yet available. Such information comes from interactions between the two partners, since a loving attitude becomes more knowledge-based. As time goes by, the issue of suitability gains greater importance, and the gap between the two scales could grow. We update and refine the two scales over time. Thus, a woman whose spouse is not particularly sensitive might say that, over time, his lack of sensitivity disturbs her less, she assigns it less weight, since she finds that his other traits compensate for it. However, she might also say that he seems to her a little bit more sensitive than she initially thought. Both non-relational and relational traits can enhance romantic love. Although there is no direct positive correlation between the two groups, they often correlate. A high value in one group often increases the value in the other. Thus, rich and charming people are often able to enhance the romantic connection, and a caring person is frequently considered of higher overall value. To sum up, constant comparison of your partner to others is contrary to the spirit of profound romantic love. Long-term lovers are not in the business of accounting and comparing. They are busier with bettering their relationship than in having a better partner than someone else. People often think that by finding the perfect person, they will find their perfect partner. They are wrong. A partner can be just good enough on the meritocracy scale, but still be ideal on the suitability scale. Suitability, not meritocracy, is the name of the romantic game. As it turns out, two imperfect people can form a perfect romantic relationship. The book points out the presence of many phenomena whose coexistence in romantic relationships seems paradoxical. Mild and wild intensity, sensitivity and indifference, distance and closeness, calmness and excitement, nurturing and preventing, as well as flexibility and stability. These apparent paradoxes stem from our desire to draw one comprehensive, consistent, intellectual picture for all people, all of the time. However, we now know better. The dynamism and partiality of the emotional and romantic realms mean that emotional and romantic experiences can be radically mixed. Today's romantic reality combines great diversity and restricted flexibility. While we cannot romantically indulge in everything we want and still stay healthy, we also do not need to go on hunger strike. Adopting a moderate diet never killed anyone.
Article 2. The Ontology of Long-Term Profound Love by Cecily Amon. In The Arc of Love, Aaron Benzeyev, 2019, aims to convince us of the possibility of enduring romantic love. 5. What he also often refers to as long-term profound love, Benzeyev, 2019, page 14. Such love is not to be simply equated with enduring love or romantic love, which he also respectively refers to as long-term romantic relationships and profound love. And these two kinds of love can come apart, Benzeyev 2019, 11, page 66. Benzeyev fulfills his aim throughout his book by providing accounts of enduring romantic love which may make those who have yet to experience such love optimistic about its possibility, and those who are in the midst of actualizing such a love more secure in the path they chose. It is also a book that I would highly recommend to those who are still wondering exactly what romantic love is in general regardless of its endurance and how they might achieve it. So, I will not contest Benzeyev's claim that enduring romantic love is possible. My concern in this review is with specifying what Benzeyev believes to be the differentia and the genus of enduring romantic love, along with his claim that love is not a property of nor resides in the connection between a lover and their beloved, More specifically, I will be concerned with precisifying Benzaev's account of the ontological nature and structure of enduring romantic love, especially in terms of what differentiates enduring romantic love from what Benzaev might refer to as acute romantic love and extended romantic love. In other words, I will be concerned with what Benzaev regards to be the differentia of enduring romantic love compared to the kind of emotion that a romantic lover might have while observing that way their beloved protected their mother from the rain, which made them fall in love, or during that time when they were jealous of their beloved's colleague for the time they had together, possible occasions of acute romantic love, and the kind of love that a romantic lover might have while on a date with their beloved or perhaps while recalling their date at the end of the evening, after saying goodbye, possible occasions of extended romantic love. I will also be concerned with what it is about these kinds of experiences, if anything at all, that unify them under the genus of enduring romantic love, and I will argue that in light of my discussion, Benzaev ought to reconsider his argument against the dialogue model of love, Benzaev 2019, page 48. My conclusion, however, does not also deny that love is a property of lovers. That love is a property of or resides in the connection between a lover and their beloved can instead entail that love is also a property of lovers as well as their beloved. I begin with my account of Benzaev's notions of acute, extended, and enduring emotions, focusing on explicating their ontological structure and identifying their differentia. I then discuss the two models of romantic love that Benzaev introduces, the care model and the dialogue model, highlighting his argument against the claim that love is a property of, and in some formulations resides in, the connection between the two lovers, Benzaev 2019, page 48. Although this claim can be understood in at least one of two ways, as a claim about the essence of the genus romantic love or the essence of the overarching genus love, I will concentrate on the implication of Benzaev's argument against this claim for his conception of the genus romantic love. I will argue that Benzaev's rejection of the claim that love can be a property of or reside in the connection between two lovers jeopardizes his book's primary aim, to convince us of the possibility of enduring romantic love. Benzaev should, therefore, reconsider his claim that romantic love is not a property of or resides in the connection between two lovers, and accept that it is at least possible. Before I begin, however, it is important to note two things. First, Benzaev employs a prototype framework for conceptualizing experiences of enduring romantic love, which was initially introduced in The Subtlety of Emotions, Benzaev 2000, Sech 1. That he does so was also recently conveyed during his Author Meets Critics session for the Society for Philosophy of Emotion at the 2020 American Philosophical Association, Eastern Division Conference. As he stated during the session, "I am not in the business of defining, but rather in the more modest task of describing and explaining. I do not work with binary categories, which provide clear criteria constituting sufficient and necessary conditions for membership in the category. I rather use prototypical categories, where membership is determined by an item's degree of similarity to the best example in the category. The greater the similarity, the higher the degree of membership. The prototypical category has neither clear-cut boundaries nor equal degrees of membership. Second, although I speak of the differentia and the genus of enduring romantic love, I do not necessarily apply these terms under the presupposition of a materialistically essentialist framework about emotional categories that reifies emotions as distinct entities in themselves, independent of the emotional beings that are the subjects of such experiences." Redmond 2016. Also read Rorty 1985 and Russell 2009. I am also not presupposing a framework that requires one to give necessary and sufficient conditions for identifying either the differentia or the genus of enduring romantic love. I use these terms to simply speak of the feature or features, if any, that give a specified meaning to the use of the relevant words, such as enduring romantic love. I admit that such features, along with the genus of enduring romantic love, may be prototypical or fuzzy, but such conceptualizations do not defy giving a definition of some kind, even though such a definition can be regarded to capture only the most typical experiences of the kind in question. So, for prototypical approaches, the concern in this review is about identifying the features that identify the best example in the category, as Benzaev put it, of enduring romantic love and its greater genus romantic love: acute, extended, and enduring emotions. According to Benzaev, intentionality and feeling are two basic mental dimensions. and both can be said to describe emotions and moods as types of affective attitudes. Benzivi 2019, page 21. The intentionality of an emotion is therefore distinguished from an emotion's feeling, although both are regarded to be mental. Intentionality refers to the aboutness of an emotion, i.e., that emotions are about something, a subject-object relation, and feeling refers to what I take to be felt physiological experiences along with what Benzeyev refers to as a certain implicit or explicit evaluative stance or concern. Benzivi 2019, page 21. This is all also consistent with the view Benzeyev put forward in Subtlety of Emotions, 2000-2001. More recently, Benzeyev also noted that feelings have a primitive level of intentionality, while also denying that they entailed any kind of evaluation. As Benzeyev stated, the feeling component. I agree with Munn that one may consider feelings as having a primitive level intentionality. Since I tend to steer clear of absolute borderlines, the issue is of lesser significance to my view. However, I would certainly not identify feeling with evaluation. Also, according to Benzeyev, emotions differ from moods to the extent that moods may lack two additional components to their intentionality: a motivational component of a readiness to action, and a cognitive component of being about practical implications. Benzevi 2019, page 21. Thus, according to Benzeyev's book, in contrast with moods, emotions necessarily involve three major intentional components: cognition, evaluation, and motivation. Benzevi 2019, page 23. At this point, I want to first call attention to one particular concern I had regarding the way Benzeyev conceived the nature or structure of emotions in general. In short, given the primitive level of intentionality that feelings have, according to Benzeyev, it was a bit unclear from the Arc of Love exactly how he conceived the relationship between feelings and the other three major intentional components of cognition, evaluation, and motivation which he identified therein. In Subtlety of Emotions, however, Benzeyev noted that emotions can be divided into four basic components: cognition, evaluation, motivation, and feeling. Benzeyev 2001, page 49. Cognition, evaluation, and motivation all belong to what Benzeyev refers to as the intentional dimension of emotions, and feelings constitute their own dimensions, the feeling dimension. Both dimensions are also central to an experience of emotion. Benzeyev 2001, page 50. For Benzeyev conceived the intentionality and the feeling dimensions as two aspects of the same mental state. As Benzeyev noted, intentionality and feeling are not two separate mental entities, but rather distinct dimensions of a mental state. The typical relation between these dimensions is not that of causality, which prevails between separate entities, but that of accompanying or complementing each other. Since the two dimensions are distinct aspects of the same state, it is conceptually confusing to speak about a causal relation between them within this particular state. Benzeyev 2001, page 51. Yet Benzeyev conceptually distinguishes the feeling dimension apart from the intentional dimension, because he does not take feelings to have the adequate kind of intentionality to regard them as components of the intentional dimension. For Benzeyev, the intentional dimension is constituted by mental states that necessarily have some reference to an object, and according to Benzeyev, feelings lack this kind of intentionality. Benzeyev 2001, page 50. The intentional dimension, according to Benzeyev, also involves the emotional complexities of emotional diversity, emotional ambivalence, and behavioral emotional complexity, which respectively correspond to the cognitive, evaluative, and motivational components of emotional experiences. Benzeyev 2019, page 23. These three components can also be cashed out in more detail in terms of an emotion's typical cause by some positive or negative change in the subject's personal situation, typical focus on the subject's personal concerns, typical objects of which are other persons, typical comparative meaning which involves a deliberative emotional weighting of possibilities, and as taking place in effective time, which includes the factors of location, duration, pace, frequency, and meaningful direction. Ben. Zeva 2019, page 20. These features, respectively, of cause, focus of concern, emotional object, emotional meaning, and effective time, can also help us identify what Benzeyev refers to as the major emotional characteristics of acute emotions: instability, intensity, partiality, and brevity. Benzeyev 2019, page 18. The instability of acute emotions differentiate them from extended and enduring emotions in the sense that it indicates the introduction or experience of a novel context, which also characterizes the intensity, partiality, and brevity of acute emotional experiences. They are respectively intense, both cognitively and evaluatively focused on a narrow target, and brief, i.e. almost instantaneous. Benzévi 2019, page 19. Yet the most notable ontological characteristic of acute emotions is that they are singular or particular in occurrence, and they are the experiences on which both extended and enduring emotions are constructed. They are the atoms of emotional experiences. Extended emotions are experiences constituted by repetitive experiences of acute emotions that are bounded together by the feeling that they belong to the same emotion. Benzévi 2019, page 20. Note here the unifying role that Benzéev gives to such a feeling. This also suggests that, in extended emotions, the acute emotions which constitute them share at least the same aspects of affective time, e.g., location, duration, pace, frequency, and meaningful direction. Both acute and extended emotional experiences are, therefore, synchronic, and what significantly differentiates the two is that the first is always a current and the second is always that which is constituted by a set of acute emotions that are felt to belong to the same emotion. In contrast, enduring emotions are constituted by both acute and extended emotions. They are also the most temporally extended of the three kinds of emotional experiences, possibly lasting for a lifetime, page 21. Enduring emotions are, therefore, diachronic experiences, and may be understood as being in some sense always under construction or as always being discovered by a lover, and it seems that Benzéev would agree with both. It is also in this construction or discovery that one can find the dispositional affectivity of having an inherent, built-in potential to develop, page 22, which distinguishes enduring romantic love from both acute and extended romantic love. As Benzéev notes, this specific sense of dispositional is key for our inquiry into the possibility of long-term profound love, page 22. The caring and dialogical models of love. Benzéev also offers a discussion of what he takes to be the two most relevant models of romantic love for the topic of enduring romantic love, the care model and the dialogue model of romantic love, page 45. The care model, according to Benzéev, takes love to be centrally about a lover's concern for their beloved's well-being. It represents an essentially sacrificial kind of love, especially in its extreme versions, page 46, which is why it is often more appropriate for loving relationships between unequal partners, page 45. And although it is necessary for long-term profound love, it is not sufficient for such love, page 46. This is because, for Benzéev, long-term profound love requires a reciprocal concern for the flourishing of the other between the lover and the beloved. Such reciprocity can be found in what Benzéev refers to as the dialogue model of love, in which a mutual respect for the other's autonomy also involves a joint commitment toward shared emotional experiences and activities that lead to the personal growth of both lovers, page 46 to 47. This kind of appreciation for the beloved's autonomy leads to an emotional complexity in experiences of profound romantic love, including long-term profound love, that involves what Benzéev refers to as a kind of holistic diversity, which is the kind of diversity in which the love is directed at the beloved as a diverse, whole person, page 24. As Benzéev observes, profound romantic love involves a comprehensive attitude that takes into account the rich and complex nature of the beloved. The lover's comprehensive attitude is complex in the sense that it does not focus on simple narrow aspects of the beloved, but considers the beloved as a whole, multifaceted being. Sexual desire or friendship, by contrast, are more limited. In romantic love, we see both the forest and the trees, whereas in sexual desire, we often focus on one or several trees. Page 24. Such emotional complexity can manifest what Benzéev refers to as the emotional diversity, that of experiencing many different specific emotional states, e.g., anger, shame, and sadness. Page 23. Of our emotional experiences in general, as well as the emotional experiences of romantic love. Given the kind of emotional complexity involved in enduring romantic love, Benzéev takes the dialogue model to be more suitable for an explanation of this kind of love, although he also rejects the aspect of the dialogue model which identifies love as a property of or as residing in the connection between two lovers. Benzaev's primary reason for this rejection is his belief that doing so would also deny that various features, including feelings, can be a psychological property of lovers. As Benzaev argues, feelings such as pain or enjoyment, which are essential to love, are not a property of the connection between two lovers. Love is a psychological property of a lover. Accordingly, we would expect that some features of love, such as feelings, evaluations, and action tendencies, are properties of the lover, whereas other features, such as compatibility, resonance, and harmony, are properties of the connection. Benzaev, 2019, pages 48-49. This criticism of the dialogue model of love can be understood in at least one of two ways. It can be understood as a claim about the essence of the genus of enduring romantic love, i.e. romantic love, or the essence of the overarching genus, a love. Assuming that Benzaev is speaking of romantic love, one central question is what Benzaev believes to be the features that unify experiences of acute romantic love, extended romantic love, and enduring romantic love under the genus romantic love, albeit from a prototypical perspective. In section 4, I will address this question by focusing on the implications of Benzaev's criticism against the dialogue model of love for his conception of romantic love. I will argue that one consequence of such a criticism is that it presents Benzaev with a problem of unification. Before doing so, I will first address another central question, which will also involve identifying the differentia of acute romantic love and extended romantic love. The question of how the components of an emotional experience and the notion of dispositional affectivity, according to Benzaev, can help us identify the differentia of enduring romantic love. Acute, extended, and enduring romantic love. By profound romantic love in the first quote cited in the previous section, I take Benzaev to be referring to the genus of acute, extended, and enduring romantic love, the essence of which involves the holistic diversity that leads a lover to take a comprehensive attitude toward their beloved. Earlier, I referred to this as the genus romantic love. Given Benzaev's account of acute, extended, and enduring emotions, and his account of both the care and the dialogue model as capturing at least some of the necessary conditions of romantic love, we can propose the following accounts as possible accounts of Benzaev's notion of acute romantic love in contrast with extended romantic love and enduring romantic love. Experiences of acute romantic love are typically those brief, unstable, occurrent experiences of love in which the emotional experience is focused on the reciprocal well-being of the lover and the beloved, and the meaning of this experience gains its significance from a comparative contrast with the contents of experiences of non-romantic love. The object of the experience is the beloved taken as a whole, autonomous individual. Thus, the experience of what a lover might simply call love, when they observed that way their beloved protected their mother from the rain, might be something Benzaev would refer to as an experience of acute romantic love. An experience of extended romantic love would be constituted by similar components compared to an experience of acute romantic love, except that these experiences would be temporally extended and unified by the feeling that the discrete experiences belong to the same emotion of love. Furthermore, one might question whether or not it may also be possible, given the emotional complexity involved in romantic love, for an acute emotional experience of some other kind, e.g. jealousy, to be an experience of acute romantic love. Although one can have an experience of jealousy that is not an experience of acute romantic love, for example, I can be jealous of my siblings for the attention given to them by my mother. Consider a case in which I am jealous of my partner's colleague because they get to spend so much time with my partner. Would this experience of jealousy be an experience of acute romantic love? If so, I would refer to such an emotional experience as a meta-emotional experience, which is an emotional experience that explains another emotional experience, cf. Katz, Gottman, and Hooven 1996, along with relevant associated articles, also cf. Maselli and Castelfranchi 2019. Although Benzaev denies the need to speak of such meta-emotions, I believe doing so is quite instructive. Given the notion of a meta-emotional experience introduced here, I suggest that we can contrast both the experiences of extended romantic love and enduring romantic love with experiences of acute romantic love by noting that there is no question that the first two can be meta-emotional experiences. The question then is how experiences of extended romantic love can be differentiated from experiences of enduring romantic love? We can answer this question by focusing on the question of how an experience of extended romantic love and an experience of enduring romantic love can play their role as meta-emotional experiences, since that which binds the various components of extended romantic love or enduring romantic love, e.g., the various acute emotions that at least partially constitute these experiences, would be essential to such an explanation. Given what is stated in the Arc of Love, Benziev might conclude that the feeling that a series of acute emotions belong to the same emotion is the unifying element of extended romantic love. So, for example, the feeling that the experiences of acute surprise, anger, and contempt may all be bound by the feeling that such experiences are all components of the same extended emotion of shame, and in this way the experience of shame explains the experience of acute surprise, anger, and contempt. Benziev, however, also noted that such a feeling is only one unifying element, and that there should also be a similarity in the nature of the experience. Yet it is the nature of the experience that is in question. With regard to enduring romantic love, given the unifying element of extended emotions that Benziev identifies in his book, I initially concluded that such a feeling would also be the binding element for Benziev's conception of enduring romantic love. According to Benziev's recent comments, however, this is not the case. As Benziev states, what does unify the emotion of enduring romantic love? In addressing this question, one should not focus on one feature, but rather on various features relating to our personality and circumstances. Thus, I disagree with Munn's claim that the unifying factor is the feeling of belonging to the same emotion. This is indeed a typical subjective characteristic of extended emotions involving constant repetitions. Enduring emotions like long-term love are more complex, and such a feeling is of little relevance. In any case, it cannot be the unifying factor of enduring romantic love. Here then, we have to some extent Benziev's answer to what unifies the components of enduring romantic love into experiences of enduring romantic love in contrast with experiences of extended romantic love. Various features relating to our personality and circumstances, for experiences of enduring romantic love, and the feeling of belonging to the same emotion for experiences of extended romantic love. Yet there is a question as to whether or not what unifies experiences of enduring romantic love is enough for Benziev to fulfill his aim to convince us of the possibility of enduring romantic love. One might supplement this response with the notion of dispositional affectivity, which Benziev identifies as the key to our inquiry into enduring romantic love. For example, Benziev might suggest that such a dispositional affectivity lies in at least some feature of our personality, and given certain circumstances, the disposition to have experiences of enduring romantic love are actualized. Yet this supplement still leaves one wanting. The main problem with this response is that it does not consider the implications of the compositional relations between experiences of acute, extended, and enduring romantic love, which unfold within a temporal sequence. Note that various experiences of acute emotions, e.g., jealousy, followed by rage, followed by shame or joy, followed by appreciation, followed by admiration, each of which might also be regarded by some as an experience of acute romantic love, may all be unified as an experience of extended romantic love, even in prototypical cases. They can, therefore, be identified as components of an experience of extended romantic love. Furthermore, these same components, as well as the experience of extended romantic love under which they are unified in virtue of a feeling, can also be components of an experience of enduring romantic love. Given this, Benziev may suggest that a certain kind of dispositional affectivity is what unites all the components of an experience of enduring romantic love, but if that is the case, then the same dispositional affectivity must also be involved in each experience of acute romantic love, as well as the experience of extended romantic love, even if such components never in fact become components of an experience of enduring romantic love. In some sense, it is always in hindsight that one experiences their romantic love as an experience of enduring romantic love, and some may never have such an experience although they may have experiences of its components. These components must, therefore, be rooted in the same dispositional affectivity as that of the experience of enduring romantic love, if such an affectivity is to unify these components in such a way so as to allow for the possibility, and actuality in hindsight, of enduring romantic love. Thus, neither the dispositional affectivity nor the personality and circumstances to which Benziev appeals can help him unify the components of enduring romantic love, so as to differentiate such experiences from experiences of extended romantic love or acute romantic love. It may, however, help Benziev unify these experiences under the genus romantic love, and I will turn to this possibility in the final section of this review. Benziev can and does, however, differentiate experiences of acute, extended, and enduring romantic love in accordance with their temporal characteristic, respectively a current, extended, and potentially lasting for a lifetime. The genus romantic love. With the foregoing arguments in mind, Benziev's claim that romantic love is not a property of or resides in the connection between lovers may also challenge his aim to convince us of the possibility of enduring romantic love by challenging the possibility of its genus. Romantic love. For, assuming that one's personality and circumstances are what unify the components of enduring romantic love, especially in virtue of a certain kind of dispositional affectivity as suggested in the previous section, it may not be possible to unify acute, extended, and enduring romantic love under the genus of romantic love without presupposing that love can also reside in the relation, the connection, that exists between the lover and the beloved. Benziev himself notes that, at the heart of romantic love lies the connection between the lovers, page 82. Furthermore, he notes that, as the tie between two lovers lies at the heart of romantic love, how they interact with each other is one of the building blocks of such love, page 58. Benziev, therefore, imagines the connection involved in romantic love as a connection that informs the interaction between two lovers, and it is only through this connection that the diversity of emotional experiences that are possible in experiences of romantic love can be identified as experiences of romantic love. Yet he denies that the love in experiences of romantic love can lie in the connection between the lover and the beloved. As he recently reiterated, the ontological status of love. After describing the two models, I briefly mention in the book the ontological issue of love's location. There, I suggest that while I accept the central tenet of the dialogue approach that mutual shared interactions are essential for enduring profound love, I reject its ontological assumption that love resides in these shared interactions, which are located between the lovers. The rival view, which is compatible with the care model and which assumes that love is a property of the lover, seems to be intuitively true, as love is similar in this regard to other personal attitudes. We attribute to the lover not merely emotions, but other attitudes, such as moods, character traits, and political attitudes. Thus, it is implausible to argue that the love for a child, or the love for a country, is located somewhere between the agent and the child or the country. Benziev cites Martin Buber and Angela Krebs as proponents of the dialogue model of love, yet what he seems to find problematic about the dialogical model of love, that love is located somewhere between the lover and the beloved, can be attributed to Martin Buber, Krebs 2014, page 7. The problem with Benziev's criticism is that it is based on an uncharitable ontological interpretation of Buber's claim that love is between I and thou, Buber 1923-1937, page 14-15. In I and thou, Buber, 1923-1937, observes that the world of human beings is twofold. There is the world of relations, which is implied by the use of the primary word I-thou, and the other is the world of objectification implied by the use of the primary word I-it, Buber 1923-1937, page 3. So, in suggesting that love is between the I and the thou, Buber is suggesting that love involves the lover relating to the beloved as a subject and denies any objectification of the beloved by the lover. The between is the relation in the relating, which does not involve an experience of the beloved but rather taking one stand in relation to the beloved, 1923-1937, pages 3-6. In consideration of Benziev's account, the relation in which romantic love lies can be understood as that which is captured by the dispositional affectivity, which Benziev regarded to be the key to his inquiry into enduring romantic love, or the features of a lover's personality and circumstances that Benziev takes as the unifying element of enduring romantic love. For the kinds of relations that are relevant in the philosophy of emotion, such as the relations of emotional intentionality, are products of psychological dispositions or features of one's personality which relate one to their external circumstances. I also argued in the previous section that such a dispositional affectivity, or features of a lover's personality and circumstances, would be better suited to make sense of how the categories of acute, extended, and enduring romantic love can be unified under the genus romantic love. Granting this, to say that romantic love is located in the relation between the lover and the beloved would be to say that this kind of love is an aspect of a lover relating to their beloved as a subject, And this kind of relating can be taken to be a product of a kind of dispositional affectivity or a feature of the lover's personality. Benziev would speak of such relating as a lover relating to their beloved as a diverse, whole person, page 24, which Benziev believes to be a necessary condition for romantic love. In conclusion, by dispensing with Buber's claim that love is a relation between the lover and the beloved, Benziev can be understood as discarding what he could take as the key to unifying his categories of acute, extended, and enduring romantic love under the genus romantic love, or what he takes to be a necessary condition of romantic love. Benziev would, therefore, also be foregoing the possibility of fulfilling his aim to convince us of the possibility of enduring romantic love by rejecting that which could make his category of romantic love a unified and therefore a possible category. Accordingly, I recommend that Benziev ought to reconsider his claim and accept that it is at least possible for romantic love to also lie in or reside in the connection between a lover and their beloved. Article 3. Beyond I and Thou. Intimacy's Pronouns. By Iskra Filieva. Aaron Benziev's 2019 aim, as I understand it, is to offer an account of love that is practical but not cynical. While he opposes what he calls romantic ideology, roughly, the idea that there is one person that's right for you, and that if you find that person, the love between the two of you will conquer all, he does not wish to give up on positive romantic illusions entirely. The account reflects the modern zeitgeist. On the pages of The Arc of Love, we find discussion of open marriages, polyamory, and levels of satisfaction among monogamous and non-monogamous people. On the view Benziev puts forward, love, much like virtue for Aristotle, is, above all, activity. Dialogue and joint ventures are essential to romantic love. Benziev expresses sympathy with a dialogue model of love. Dialogue between two people who love each other is characterized by a sort of mutual attunement and synchrony. This is not to suggest that there are no conflicts in love, on Benziev's reckoning. Rather, it is to say that conflicts are handled without hostility. The connection between the lovers is more important than any quality the beloved may possess independently. Benziev 2019, page 68. Caring too is a key component of love, but PACE defenders of the alternative care model. Caring is not the essence of love, or at least not of romantic love, though it may be the essence of parental love or of the love of God for the creation. Benziev 2019, page 45. In the spirit of healthy pragmatism, Benziev urges willingness to compromise when it comes to love. A less than ideal love may still be quite good and preferable to an indefinitely long period of waiting for the perfect other. Benziev counsels romantic generosity as well, being willing to tolerate a partner's non-exclusivity in exchange for an enlargement of one's own romantic and sexual freedom. Much of what Benziev says sounds eminently reasonable. My aim in what follows is not to criticize the arc of love, but to help think through the issues he raises and perhaps go a step further than he does. What is romantic love? I wish to begin with the very idea of romantic love. Though romantic love is the ostensible topic of the book, Benziev says little about what makes love specifically romantic. The dialogue model of love with which he expresses sympathy can apply to other kinds of love, such as that between friends or siblings, as well as to relationships other than love, for instance, a therapeutic relationship. Love aside, there is dialogue in every healthy relationship. Perhaps it can be supposed that we can get romantic love by adding sex to some other kind of dialogical love. But that cannot be the answer. While sexual attraction is no doubt important, as Benziev himself notes, friends may have sex with each other, as well as good dialogue, without love or without romantic love. They call it friends with benefits. On the flip side, we cannot turn romantic love into either non-romantic love or into a different kind of attachment by subtracting sex from the equation. A person who, like Jake Barnes from Hemingway's 1926 novel The Sun Also Rises, is incapable of sexual intimacy due to injury may nonetheless be in a loving, romantic relationship. In Hemingway's novel Jake Barnes's Love, Brett Ashley does not want to be more than good friends with Jake. The reasons for this are complex and by no means reducible to Jake's inability to have sex, but Jake's injury is probably not helping. However, we can well imagine a different woman in Brett's place who falls in love with Jake and makes a commitment to him. There may be sadness in a celibate relationship of this sort, but that sadness may be further evidence of the depth of love. Indeed, we can imagine a case in which the partner who cannot have sex, in a spirit of generosity, encourages the able-bodied one to have sex with others and the able-bodied one does so. But the sex is not fully satisfactory. There is a difference between sex, even sex with someone you are physically attracted to, and sex with the person you love. Iris Murdoch, 1973, makes a related point. In The Black Prince, she says this: the absolute yearning of one human body for another particular body, and its indifference to substitutes, is one of life's major mysteries. There are, I am told, people who just want a woman or a man. I cannot conceive of this state of affairs, and it does not concern me. Murdoch, 1973, page 326. I conclude that sex is not the missing ingredient. One may, perhaps, approach the issue of the nature of romantic love from the opposite side and ask what is lost when romantic love is gone. It may but need not be dialogue, caring, or sexual attraction. Sometimes, love is gone yet people stay together precisely because they still get along and care for each other. They can still talk. They may respect each other and try to help each other grow. Indeed, it may be that both partners hope love will return because they get along so well. Yet it may seem that the blessing of the gods of love has been withheld. There is dialogue, caring, and even sexual intimacy, but not romantic love. The question is, what is missing? Benziv does not tell us, but I wish he had. Beyond I and Thou. My second comment concerns what I would like to call the romantic we perspective. In discussing the dialogue model of love, Benziv references Martin Buber. Benziv, 2019, page 46. I welcome the reference. Buber has probably done more than anyone to underscore the importance of the second-person perspective and the difference between regarding another third personally, from an observational point of view, and addressing the other as an interlocutor, a thou. However, I wish to suggest here that when we are lucky enough to find love, something else happens. There emerges a composite of the two lovers. A first-person plural, a we. We is the pronoun of romantic intimacy. Benziv himself touches upon this issue briefly and quotes Nozick, who expresses a sentiment similar to mine here. Writes Benziv, Robert Nozick argues that romantic love is wanting to form a we with that particular person. Benziv, 2019, page 47. But I don't think Benziv appreciates the full force of this remark, as he mentions Nozick and Buber in the same breath. The we of intimacy, I want to argue, goes beyond second personal address, beyond I and thou. While two people who love each other remain separate people and ideally retain their autonomy to a large extent, there is a sense in which they no longer think of themselves as fully independent and separate, nor does society think of them that way. The idea here is not that the two merge to the point of losing their own identities, as per the fusion model Benziv rejects as unhealthy. Rather, the point is that when the lovers have attained a we perspective, each believes the other has a say in all major decisions and vice versa, and not for legal reasons but for reasons that have to do with love and commitment. Sometimes, when love is gone, one partner may say to the other, "We can work this out," to which the other may reply, "There is no we," alleging that the composite has disintegrated. Once love ceases to function as glue connecting the lovers, they become detached from each other once again. In his discussion of polyamory, a model of love that allows for multiple intimate partners, rather than one primary partner plus one or more secondary ones, as in the case of sexually open relationships, Benziv suggests that this type of relationship is compatible with deep and enduring romantic love. He does not say that achieving enduring love in a polyamorous relationship is easy, and indeed, he emphasizes the likelihood that feelings of jealousy may arise, but he does say that enduring love may nonetheless emerge in polyamory. This is because, on his view, we can love more than one person. Love, he tells us, is not like butter. It doesn't get thinner as we spread it more and more widely. Benziv, 2019, page 210. This may be so. Parents, for instance, may be able to love the fifth or seventh or tenth child just as much as they love the first, and it may seem to them that their hearts are ever expanding to make room for each newborn child. But romantic love is unlike parental love in that enduring romantic love, but not parental love, involves a we perspective. Of course, a we perspective may emerge in a variety of contexts, for instance, when a father and a son are baking muffins together, when two soldiers are trying to survive together, or when two philosophers are working on a co-authored book. In all these cases, people act not solely as individuals but as parts of a composite. But these are temporary, local alliances. The we of romantic intimacy is global, and it persists, Two people who love each other don't make important plans without consulting their partner. They don't think to themselves, I will move to New York City, or I will buy a condo. They think of what they will do together. Indeed, some of the most painful breakups involve cases in which one partner is caught off guard due to having been kept in the dark. The we may have ceased to exist long ago, but the spurned lover did not know this, as the other may have kept up appearances while secretly making plans that concern only him or herself. If this is right, and if one nonetheless wants to maintain that polyamory is compatible with romantic love, then one must explain what sort of we might be expected to emerge in a polyamorous arrangement. Can the we that two people share survive the addition of a third person? If so, how? The intransparent mind of the other. There is a final point I wish to make before closing this discussion. I just argue that there is a we phase in a romantic love relationship, and that this phase supersedes the I and thou phase. I should note that to the extent two lovers retain their autonomy, the I and thou phase never ends, strictly speaking. So what we have here is not so much succession of two phases as a case in which the we phase starts later and overlaps with the I and thou phase. That's one way in which the sketch of the arc of love Benziev offers us is incomplete. The arc bends toward a we perspective. There is another way in which the account may be said to be incomplete. There is a phase that precedes I and thou, the I and other phase. When we first fall in love with someone, the mind of the other is to a great extent intransparent to us. We alternate between regarding the other as a thou, and trying to gauge the other's thoughts and feelings third personally by doing such things as talking to other people who know the object of our romantic interest or spying on the other on social media. This perceived impenetrability of the other's mind is the reason why nothing the other says at this stage is sufficient to give us the reassurance we seek. This is also why, if we begin to doubt the other's feelings for us, whether with or without ground, a previously intimate relationship may devolve and go back to this earlier phase. Both George Eliot, 1860-1997, and Marcel Proust, 1925-1982, underscore our tendency to see the beloved whose feelings we have doubts about as intransparent to us and as unknowable. Eliot writes, "Jealousy is never satisfied with anything short of an omniscience that would detect the subtlest folds of the heart." Eliot, 1860-1997, page 397. Proust suggests that the mental lives of others are always obscure to us, actually, but we don't notice this, because we don't much care about what they think or feel. Jealousy throws the opaqueness of the other's mind into sharp relief and makes us take notice. It is one of the faculties of jealousy to reveal to us the extent to which the reality of external facts and the sentiments of the heart are unknown elements which lend themselves to endless supposition. We imagine that we know exactly what things are and what people think for the simple reason that we do not care about them. But as soon as we have a desire to know, as the jealous man does, then it becomes a dizzy kaleidoscope in which we can no longer distinguish anything. Proust, 1925-1982, page 529. When the object of love is subject to endless interpretation, he or she remains an other whose mind is hidden from view and whose motives must be inferred from observational evidence. For this reason, while love generally begins with falling in love is not yet love. Benziev is not clear on this point and conflates falling in love with love. He calls this initial phase fresh love, and says that fresh love is more intense though less profound than mature love. He writes, "When it comes to eggs, we look for two things, taste and nutritional value. And it is when eggs are fresh that these are at their peak. Life gets more complicated when love is at stake. The intensity of excitement, the taste, is strongest when love is fresh, but the profundity of the connection, the nutritional value, is often best when love is mature. While the old saying has it that revenge is a dish best served cold, I believe that romantic love should never be cold. It does not need to be served at the boiling point, however. Warm is very good as well." Benziev, 2019, page 242. But if the foregoing considerations are right, Benziev's suggestion here is misleading. The fresh love, which he, on the same page, calls also intense wild love, is not love at all. The fledgling we at this initial phase is too unstable for the relationship to count as one of love. What we have at this point is excitement and perhaps a promise of love, a promise that may or may not be fulfilled. In addition, the lovers do not yet know each other, so whatever they are excited about, it isn't the other person, the real other. Finally, love may be checkered by periods of doubt, jealousy, and reversal to the I and other phase. It is this early phase as well as the subsequent we perspective that seems to me to be largely missing from Benzaev's otherwise thoughtful and informative discussion of the arc of love. 70.824. This marks the end of the 2020 Volume 2, Issue 1 Summer Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please go to 2020 Volume 2, Issue 1 Summer Podcast Edition, Part 2, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, to continue listening to this issue.